Yeah, it is. Men are very much, they wear a long undergarment that is kind of like a, you know, kind of t-shirt that has the two straps and then it goes down and around below the middle section. Yeah.
I was
going to throw
the
tapes
on over there.
I haven't started yet.
Oh, good. I was going to say, could you introduce yourself to
yeah.
the tape?
Yeah. Okay. Whenever you're ready.
The tape's already.
Okay.
Also, is everybody there coming up today? And is there a reason for that? Is there a religious reason for that? Or is it just for sex?
Not that I know of. Religiously, I don't see any particular reason for it. It's, some students don't talk or anything. They want you to protect. They want him. And students dress up for PE, sometimes they come to my classes in just the Western clothes. But most of my students wear these two things every day. It gets very boring after a while. Just to see the white and the red. And this, of course, is the woman's garment, the abaya, which generally have time to put on. And you can see the drastic contrast between the white and the black. The women are required to wear this even in the hot sun. Let me begin then by saying my name is John Avery, and myself and Carol live in the Middle East in Saudi Arabia, where I teach at the University of Petroleum and Minerals. The university is about 20 years old, 24 years old. It was started as a support university to the Arabian American Oil Company, which we know as Aramco. And at that time, it was under the Ministry of Petroleum and Minerals, thus its name. And after a number of years, it then became one of the major universities within the country and has since switched under the aegis of the Ministry of Education. So it's a totally Saudi-run institution. I don't work for an American company. But the unique thing about our university is that all instruction is done in English. So whether we're teaching in biology or chemistry or physics or sociology, which there are a few courses, all the instruction is done in English. So my job then as an English teacher is to bring up the level of students' English to college level English. Much the same as my job is when I teach in an American university, which I did in Portland, with foreign students to try to raise them up to college level. So all students come in, all male students come in. We only have male students. There are women's universities in Saudi Arabia, but I would never teach there. Not because I don't want to, but because I wouldn't be allowed to. And if I did, it would have to be via videotape. It would never be in a direct classroom situation. Anyway, I teach at the university in the English department, and the English department is divided into two sections. One is the orientation program, where all the entry students come in, and they take this intensive English course for an entire academic year, 25 hours per week. In addition to that, they also have mathematical courses, math courses, and some shop and other introductory things. And part of the purpose of our course is to make it a hurdle course to be kind of the filtering agent for a lot of the students. So only 60% or 50 to 60% of those we take in actually make it to the freshman year. So we try to think we're tough, but anyway, the students that do pass on then enter the university, start taking their courses for like any other university student, and that's where I'm currently teaching now. I'm not in the orientation program any longer, but in the university English program, which means that I'm teaching freshman and sophomore composition and technical report writing, those sorts of things. So more of a support service to the other academic courses on campus. So much the same as you would have at a regular American or English language university, the structure of things. We've been there for 3 years, and we will be going back for at least one more. We sign on in blocks of two-year contracts. Where we are located is on the eastern side, the Gulf side of Saudi Arabia. Just to give you a quick world view, we fly from New York straight over to Saudi Arabia. Over that, well, I'm not exactly sure which route we take, but we usually come over Eastern Europe and down here in this way into Dhahran. And Dhahran is in the center of the oil-producing area of Saudi Arabia. All the oil is found in the eastern province and in the Gulf. There are offshore wells. And this is the rich Gulf state area where you have the different Gulf countries, Oman, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, all these little, what used to be kind of sheikdoms have incorporated into various countries, Kuwait, Iraq, and of course Iran. And so we are right in this region where oil was discovered in the 20s and 30s, and has since grown to be their foremost source of income, what they're famous for. The other parts of the country, if we expand this map now, and here's Saudi Arabia, the Arabian Peninsula, with the different Gulf states around us, the Red Sea here to the west, Egypt, the continent of Africa, and the Mediterranean Sea. Again, we're over here in Dhahran. Israel is up here for comparison. Saudi Arabia comes very close to bordering with Israel at one point down here in the south. And in the middle of the country is the capital, Riyadh, where the king resides. And there are really three metropolitan centers in Saudi Arabia: the Dhahran, Dammam, Al-Khobar area, which is where we live, the Riyadh area, and the Jeddah area. In addition to that, there's also Mecca and Medina, which are the holy cities, and they are up here in the mountains, in which, by the way, we cannot go into as non-Muslims. So that's basically the layout of Saudi Arabia, the three cities kind of straddling the middle of the country, roughly, the major metropolitan areas. And the majority of the country is, of course, desert. Great sand deserts that extend, particularly this area, which even the Arabs call the empty quarter. And it's just absolutely sand dunes. Now there's a lot of oil in there, and there's exploration, but it's left only to the nomadic tribes and has been for millennia. And other areas, of, I mean, there are deserts within a desert, is what I'm saying. That this is this kind of rough, gravelly plain deserts, and aside from that, are these monstrous mountainous dunes of sand that extend out here. But actually, in a lot of ways, it's a very, we have a coastal town kind of environment here, being on the Gulf. And we, at the university, has a beach that we spend a lot of time at for recreation. So that's where we're at, just to give you a background. This lecture that I'm giving is, our talk is one of two on the history of Islam. And I just wanted to set the scene by telling you that I am an English teacher. I am not a theologian of any training or a historian, per se. I'm just a person like yourself who, like a person working for the oil company, would find himself in the Middle East, and I hope my perceptions are similar to what you would have if you found yourself there. Islam, generally, is a religion that's little understood in America or the West in general. And it's been seen recently, of course, by the whole spate of incidents that have happened around the world as a religion of fanatics, a religion of people with outlandish modes of behavior. I mean, if we go over some of the incidents that have happened in the past few years, the overtaking of the Shah in Iran, in the subsequent hostage situation, the numerous hijackings, particularly with the TWA plane last summer, the Libyan situation, the Achille Laurel, and of course the continuing turmoil of Palestine and Israel and the Palestinians, we get this view of the Middle East and of Islam and Arabs in general of a place fraught with turmoil. But in order to understand it, and I think it's very important that Americans understand Islam and Arabs, especially in current history, we have to go deeper into what they're about. I think it's important because it has worked out to be a very dangerous situation for us, particularly with the bombing of Libya, that we've kind of entered into the violence of the region. And if we are to understand that and why we're there, and if we should go further or not go further, I think we have to have more history, more understanding of the region. Islam should be seen as one of the world's great religions. It is an undeniable fact that it has, I believe, over 800 million adherents. And the people who ascribe to Islam extend a great region of the world, an ancient part of the world. They extend from all across North Africa, across the Sahara Desert, and these regions of North Africa, from Morocco onwards, through the Middle East, which includes Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Somalia and these countries in here, through the whole Arabian Peninsula region. Turkey is a major Islamic country, across Iran, Pakistan, Afghanistan, into India, into China, into Russia. It's expected, I believe, that 20% of Russia's population may be Muslims in the future. So it's a major, major world religion. And it also extends down here into these Southeast Asian island groups. And in fact, the largest Islamic country in numbers of population, I believe, is Malaysia. Oh, no, Indonesia. A little known fact, we often think of Muslims as being in Saudi Arabia, but Saudi Arabia only has 6 million people at the most. And Indonesia, I think they said there's something like 90 million Muslims there. So the numbers there greatly overbalance. And in China, if just 1% of China's population is Muslim, that becomes what? If they have, I forget, a billion people, 10 million, you know, that's more than in Saudi Arabia already. And that's just 1% of the population. So a large number of people in the world are Muslims, and we're largely unaware of that. And I think in order to discuss it, we kind of have to open our minds, suspend our disbeliefs, you know, just say, well, who are these people? And there was a quote that I read in preparing for these talks that I really liked, and it was by J.B. Phillips, who was one of the translators of the New Testament. He said, "If there's ever to be a happy and peaceful world, we have, all of us, got to learn to understand and to love the difficult, the exasperating, and the unlovable." And to us, in our current history, these people seem difficult and exasperating and unlovable, but I think there's a reason to understand. Islam begins with Muhammad, and Muhammad is the single prophet, the single most important prophet, at least, of Islam. He was born in A.D. 570. Now, I say A.D. because their calendar is quite different. In fact, it's an interesting fact to note that this is the year 1460, I think, in the Islamic calendar. So they begin with a point in Muhammad's ministry when he moved to Medina. But anyway, if we stick with our calendar, he was born in the year 570 in the city of Mecca. Now, Mecca at that time was kind of a trading center of that part of the world. And the reason for that is that it was a place where the goods of Persia and India and the East would come up into Europe. Now, the way they do that now is to go into the Red Sea and go through the Suez Canal and continue on up into European ports. But that time, and it still continues, still is the case, the Red Sea is notorious for its coral beds. So the ships could not successfully navigate this region, so they would have caravans that would go along the coastal area of Saudi Arabia, and then from Mecca, which is right here, these caravans would disperse into Damascus, up in Syria, which is here, or go east, go west, and up in this way. So anyway, Mecca became an exchange point, a trading center. It was also a religious center. The religion of the time of Muhammad was one of tribal religion. There was no set one god. There was this one god, Allah, who was later to become the name of the only Islamic deity. But there were also other minor gods, so it was a polytheistic kind of religion that was prevalent in the region. And so it was a religious center where the different tribes would come there and do certain rituals in Mecca, and for this reason it was a vital major area in the Arabian Peninsula. Now the Arabian Peninsula in general was not occupied by major imperialistic powers. We have to remember that this is a time of world history where major empires rubbed against each other like great continental plates and vying for different control of regions. But the Arabian Peninsula throughout history has never really been worth the trouble to conquer it, because it hasn't contained all that many riches. Now, of course, it does now with the oil, but it didn't then, and it hasn't throughout history. So what control that was there was kind of through intercessors, kind of through local tribes that made control and paid duty to the King of Kings in Persia or the Byzantine emperor. But they never really had any direct control, no occupying army per se. So it was a religious center, kind of a hurly-burly kind of town where a lot kind of went on in terms of people coming in and going. And these shrines of worship were controlled by this clan called the Quraishi. Now, this was the clan into which Muhammad was born. And these people were the ruling class, the trading family of the region. And they had control over the religious shrines, and they had a vested interest in how things were and how things shouldn't change. If we think of it in terms of Christian history, it was like selling indulgences. They didn't want the apple cart disrupted. And when Muhammad was born into that, that was something that he had to overcome, this tradition and his background. Well, anyway, he was born not a rich member of this clan, but kind of one of the minor families within the clan. And he had to work for a living, and he worked for this rich widow named Khadija, who had him go to Damascus do some trading for him in one of these caravans. Now, his trip to Damascus is significant because Damascus at that time was a Christian town. And he encountered, undoubtedly, then Christians and Jews in that region, and encountered the traditions and revelations of Christianity and Judaism. And she liked him so well, and he carried out his affairs so well, that she married him. Now, it was a very advantageous marriage for Muhammad, economically as well as personally, because this woman supported him in life. He didn't have to go on any more of these caravan trips, so he was free to pursue the mystic kind of leanings that he had, he also benefited from her personal belief in him and support. So he was prone to meditate in kind of the hot, craggy caves around Mecca. And at one point, he believed that he received a calling from the angel Gabriel to recite the word of God. And this is the beginning of Muhammad's ministry, when he believed that he was called by God to be the prophet of God, and the prophet of God in the great tradition of the monotheistic faith. Now, as I said, it was a polytheistic culture that he was born into and that there was a lot of vested interest in. And for him to break out of that was a major, major rebellious act, because he had to fight not only the religious tradition, but the economic, the business interests of the time. So I think at this point we can see Muhammad as a true mystic, a person unmotivated by political ambition, a person who really was seeking God, and whether he actually received a true revelation or not, of course, is a point of faith and a point of difference of faith between Muslims and Christians and Jews or whatever religious tradition we're talking about. But of course the Muslims believed that he was a prophet and they did receive revelation. And this also becomes the point that if you accept him as a prophet, and a true prophet of God, as Muslims do, then all that he does and all that he says becomes revelation of God, and that becomes the religion of Islam. Because it was by Muhammad and through Muhammad that the whole Islamic tradition is conveyed. The book of the Quran, which I have here, translation in English anyway, is wholly through the words of Muhammad, or the words that Muslims would say that he received. Now, this is no mean feat. I mean, that's a thick book. And words that he was supposed to have received and have written down in Arabic and made into the Quran. So all of that is a revelation that came through him. Okay. His initial revelation was simple. There is one God. None of this polytheistic stuff anymore. There's only one God. And this is the main tenet and the main thing that we as Christians have to share with Muslims. There is one holy God. And there are no minor gods. There's no side acts. Nobody else gets in on it. But there's one God demanding justice, demanding obedience. Obedience is the main word in Islam. The word Islam itself means submission. And that's a very important point. And it's almost the first thing that a Muslim will tell you if he's describing his religion. It means submission. And a Muslim is one who submits, one who obeys the commandments of God. So that was his message. There is one God, and conveniently enough, Muhammad is his prophet. And that people must repent and obey, give up their idol worship, their licentious ways, or be condemned to hellfire. There is a real hellfire tradition within Islam. It was quite radical for his time. He talked about trading honestly. He talked about carrying out your caravans with a good degree of discretion and treating women. Although we see Islam as the main oppressor of women in current history, at that time it was a radical influence for the better treatment of women. So he first saw himself as a reformer and a restorer of the monotheistic truth as revealed to Christians and Jews. He thought that Christians and Jews had gone astray with the revelation, particularly Christians with the Pauline direction that Paul had taken the church in, particularly with the doctrine of the Trinity. He saw the Trinity as a belief in polytheism, three gods instead of one, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, instead of a triune unity in one God. And this is still a argument against Christianity today. They say we believe in one God, but really we believe in three. He had few followers in the beginning. He was highly rejected. He hit a low point in his life in the year 619 when his wife died. A group of the believers were so persecuted they had to send them off to Ethiopia, what was in Abyssinia, over in Africa. Down here, to escape that persecution. It was at that point that Muhammad believed he received what they call the night journey, the year 620, when he made either a literal or a religious kind of mystical journey from Mecca to Jerusalem. He wanted to tie together his revelation with the Judeo-Christian tradition. So it was going to Jerusalem, where God showed him signs and rejuvenated him. And at that point, he became stronger. Some more people converted to Islam. But he was still having a very difficult time in overcoming the Quraishi, the vested interests in Mecca. So some people from the city of Medina, which at that time was just a small oasis and still is an oasis where dates are grown. In fact, the dates we have here today come from Medina. Asked him to come up there and to kind of bring together some factional groups. They had no vested religious interests in the shrines. They had none of that. And they saw him as a leader who had a lot of personal charisma and personal wisdom to bring together the different groups. So he went to Medina. The choice was a necessary one, not a voluntary one. He really wanted to convert Mecca. He wanted Mecca to be his main center. It was where the religious shrines were, and he knew that if he was ever to bring in all of Arabia, he would have to take Mecca. So he went to Medina, and his period of time in Medina was one of establishment, of becoming really drawing together a community. The revelations turned out to be more direct and less about the nature of God and more about the individual acts. There was a lot of law giving. Social and legal issues were dealt with, as I said. And there was a real sense of Medina coming together and becoming Muhammad's community, becoming the first Islamic community. It was the city of the Prophet, and that's what the word Medina means, city of the Prophet.
nonprofit, but they entered into a working agreement for social and business and legal purposes. Now, this extended for a while, but later was to cause a major breakup, which extends to today. And at the point that the Jews rejected him, Muhammad suddenly received a lot of revelations which were contrary to the Jews. And I think it, also at this point, the nature of Muhammad's ministry changed. From being a person concerned with the nature and the honesty of being a believer in a single God, it starts to become very political, politically oriented. And it changed the direction of the prayers. For example, the people were supposed to pray towards Jerusalem. It's called the Qibla. But they then changed that to Mecca and changed the Sabbath day, or the holy day in Islam, from Saturday to Friday. And this becomes very troublesome for the Jews because they have to do their shopping on Friday in order to prepare for the Sabbath. So it created trouble that way. And he also incorporated many of the religious traditions from the old religious background that he was born into Islam. For example, there is this circling around, there's a central building in Mecca that's called the Kaaba. And Kaaba, I think, means cube or square-like box, in which it is. It's a big cubic box of a building. And Muslims in their lifetime pilgrimage are supposed to go to Mecca and to do a series of rituals there in order to be a good Muslim. And many of these rituals come from the old tribal religions from before. And one of these is to circle around it seven times. There's a black stone that has to be kissed. There's a well that comes from... Wells are very important. In fact, wells were symbols of God. Wells and stones and trees and so on. So a lot of these traditions were then incorporated into to the religion. So it seems obvious to me anyway, although it wouldn't be seen this way by a Muslim, that a lot of the revelations seem very politically motivated in order to bring in the Meccans, you know, bring in Greater Arabia. But still, even with that kind of politically advantageous thing, Muhammad should be seen as a person who was still very religiously oriented, very much a mystic. But he also at this time started to incorporate many of the old raiding traditions of raiding the caravans of the Meccans who were going up to Damascus because Medina was well on the way. And this started a warring between the two. And Muhammad was involved in this warring thing. And to me, that's one of the major differences between Jesus and Muhammad, is that Jesus would have nothing to do with political ambitions or violence. But Muhammad entered into it and said that he was wounded at one point. Victory was theirs, and victory was seen as a stamp of God's approval on the war. And eventually this warring settled in a treaty, and then the treaty was broken, and Muhammad was able to march into Mecca, take it without violence, and without a lot of retribution. And, you know, and many times when groups fight against groups, they go into a city and sack and ruin and rape and all that. But they didn't do that. They went in and destroyed the idols of the holy shrines. And it was a great ambition realized by Muhammad. And Mecca became then the primary holy city of Islam, which it remains to be this day. So then you have the three holy cities of Islam: Mecca, Medina, the Prophet's city, where in fact he returned to after his taking of Mecca, and Jerusalem. Mecca and Medina, as I said, you cannot go into as a non-believer. Jerusalem, of course, is held by the Jews, so there's no restrictions there. His remaining years were spent in consolidating the faith, taking control, extending, bringing in the tribute from the various tribes within Arabia. He died in the year 632 at the age of 63. Not a rich man. He took no comfort in being riches or having palaces. But he had accomplished a great many things in his lifetime. He had given his people a religion with a great deal of power, white-hot fervor for it. He had given them a language base through the Quran, and it remains today as the basis of classical Arabic, one of the world's great languages. And he gave them a political coherence that they had never known up to this point. And Islam was able to develop after Muhammad's lifetime, within 100 years, to be a major political, religious influence in the world that, as it turned out, was also a major cultural and artistic influence. And thank God they were, because for many of the traditions and philosophies were saved not by through the Dark Ages of Europe, but through the Muslim peoples keeping those books and knowledge alive. Okay. That basically is the life of Muhammad. Are there any questions? Maybe I should pause at this point. Yeah.
I have a lot, but I'll just ask one. Do the Muslims consider our God the same as theirs?
Yes.
All are different.
No, that's a very important thing. They don't even like English speaking people to use the word Allah, because that sets up the understanding that there is a different God. They prefer us to just use our own word, God, and to leave Allah for Arabic speaking people, just because it's just a translation. So they very much want us to consider the Judeo-Christian God as our God, as their God.
This is probably a better question. Do we consider Allah our God?
Well, do we?
what is
who is God? God is the creator of the universe, and that's who they see him as.
Yeah.
God in many ways is who, God is God, and there's truth to that, but how we know God is how we make him to be, or what we believe him to be. If we believe certain attributes of God is to be holy and merciful, and the Muslims share that concept of God. Uh-huh.
Perhaps a better question would be, how did Muhammad consider Jesus?
He saw Jesus as a very holy man, as a prophet of God. And he is highly respected in Islam. In fact, we are called people of the book, is the way of referring to Christians and Jews. So there is, theoretically anyway, a great deal of respect extended to us. In practice, that works out to little or no tolerance, especially in Saudi Arabia. But Jesus was seen as a prophet, as a revealer of holy things about God, but not, and this is very important, not as the Son of God, not as divinity come to earth. And to believe in that to a Muslim is to believe in polytheism.
Mm-hmm. Do they not have a Savior?
No, there is no Savior. And I'm going to get into more of the basic beliefs and so on. There is no Savior because there is no need for redemption. There's only need for obedience. There's not such a strong sense of sin in Islam. There's obedience to the will of God, but there's not a sense of doing wrong and needing to be brought before God through Christ. No, there's no sin. Yes.
Do you believe in eternity?
Yes, very much. Yes.
Heaven and hell?
Yes. Oh, yes. I'm sorry, the question was, do they believe in eternity? And yes, they do believe in eternity. Yes, there is a very strong hellfire, and there is a very strong beautiful paradise that believers are supposed to enter into. And this is one of the reasons, and we can go into it more tomorrow, but one of the reasons that you have these mass droves of people in Iran willing to throw themselves before the Iraqi guns, because they believe they will enter into paradise immediately if they're fighting a holy war. And paradise for them is one of splendor, of dark-eyed virgins treating men, of course it's a very male-oriented religion, and you can imagine, and ever-flowing streams, and in the context of the Middle East, dark-eyed virgins and ever-flowing streams is a very scrumptious kind of vision. Yes, I'm sorry, who was first, and then you.
Is there a feeling that with Christianity one can do wrong and do things which are not right to be forgiven, and in Islam that would not be really acceptable? You yourself are responsible for the thing you do. You don't have someone else who takes away the guilt.
That's right. And this, I think, is the appeal of Islam. We might ask, what in the world, why would anybody follow this religion? Because it seems kind of austere and distant. But it's a very direct religion, man and God. No intercessors, no intermediaries, no priests. There really is no clergy outside of Iran, per se. The main tradition in Islam is not to have the intercessors. There's no Christ. We are responsible to God, our Maker and Creator, directly. And whether we are obedient to Him is something between us and Him. Although there is a very definite sense of fatalism, that we are kind of destined to be who we are. And in fact, one of the main phrases that you hear from the first day you get off the plane in Saudi Arabia is, Inshallah, as God wills. And as God wills is how it will be. But there's no intercessor. I'm sorry.
In your practical day-to-day affairs in Saudi Arabia, do they use the Western calendar or the Islamic calendar?
Both. They'll say it's the 10th of Muharram corresponding to the 10th of September, 1986.
And is there any development of what we would call secularism?
Well, this is a creeping fear. They don't want secularism, of course, because they see this is what happened in Iran, right? And that was the great backlash that was felt, and the Shah had allowed practically anything. I mean, there were women walking down the streets in hot pants and makeup and long hair and all this stuff, and the people were appalled. As well they might be. I mean, it seriously went against their traditions. Western culture was brought in wholesale with little opposition by the government. And this is one of the things that the people responded to. Yes?
Yes, in the Muslim tradition, there's a lot. Is there something more revenge within? Seems like there's...
Yes. I said last week, and I think it's really true, that the history of the Middle East is nothing but long memories. Not that it hasn't... I hate to say a lot of these things without thinking of our own culture, because it wasn't so long ago that women were treated, and still are in many ways, of course, treated as an inferior class. But I mean, women 50, 70 years ago had to wear garments that extended from the neck down to their ankles, and so on. But and the history of Christian Europe, so-called Christian Europe, has been one of revenge and retribution. But yes, there definitely seems to be less a tradition of forgiveness, interpersonal forgiveness, and forgiveness by a group. Yeah.
El Hajj, is the book that was written about how...
Don't read that book. Don't read
that
book.
How did they see that book?
The Hajj is the annual or the once in a lifetime pilgrimage that one is supposed to make to Mecca. It was a book written by Leon Uris. I don't know if any of you read that, but I haven't even read it. I haven't read it, but some friends have over there, and they say it's very anti-Arab and just treats the Arab as imbeciles. And Uris takes a very strong defense of Israel. He writes it from that perspective. Yeah.
Inasmuch as the Arabs and the Jews both worship the same God, I realize they're not very friends, but basically, is that because of political, economic, and social reasons?
Well, the division, as I explained, started way back with Muhammad. He was rejected, he was not seen as a true prophet by the Jews. He was mocked now to the Middle Eastern mind. Mockery is not very well accepted. It's seen as an affront upon one's personal dignity. So there is this historical enmity. But up until the establishment of the State of Israel, there were Jewish communities in every Arab country, and not persecuted communities. And in fact, until they, in Palestine itself, the Arabs and the Jews existed with a fair degree of tolerance of one another. But it is really, and we have got to see this in this country, it is really Israel which is and the Palestinian question and the disenfranchisement of the Palestinian people, that is the main gripe that the Arab people have against us, and they have a very fair gripe. I mean, it was like, I mean, if we can attribute it to Canadians coming into Iowa and saying, we're going to establish ourselves here, I'm sorry, this is no longer your country, and carrying on a military campaign to exclude Americans or to treat them as second-class citizens, put Iowans in refugee camps and herd them all together. It's very, I mean, that's a very simplistic way of putting it, but there were Palestinian peoples living there. It wasn't exactly an established country, but they were then excluded from being a ruling part of that country, and they still are. And we've got to address that issue somehow to give some justice to that region. Yeah.
How is the tradition, or since there's not an established clergy, is it the family's responsibility to pass on the heritage, or the...
Well, there is a community of believers, and there's a community of leaders and followers, much kind of like the elders in the church. But elders in a church are not ordained or do not go to seminary. Now, there will be a prayer leader, but there's not a paid clergy, let's say it that way. And so the person who gets up and leads them in prayers on Friday, their Friday service is somewhat synonymous with ours, our Sunday service. There's a leader of the prayers, and then there's a sermon, even from the pulpit. But he's not a paid member. He's one who has maybe been educated by going for some religious training, but very much a member of the community, a tent maker.
Does the leader of the family keep like in the Jews?
Oh, you mean within the household?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think it's quite the same. There's a school, first of all, in Saudi Arabia, all the children who attend school, and schools are segregated right down to first grade. Isn't that right? Yeah. They have to learn the Quran, and many children learn it word for word, the entire book. So there's a teaching within the schools.
Are they not a faith of reconciliation? Somehow we don't see, the question was brought up earlier, is forgiving, but this is such an important basis of
Christianity.
Human interaction.
Oh, sure.
Not just Christianity.
Yeah.
You can't go around killing everybody that steps on your foot. There's something wrong.
Well, no, there's definitely a sense of mercy within Islam. An Islamic brother, they love to talk about Islamic brotherhood, but I don't... I guess I see that from my personal interactions, and again, this is very personal and very non-professional, but I see it as much more of a sense of maintaining your own dignity and holding a grudge and those kind of things. And that's kind of the paucity, the arrogance I see in Islam, but that's my own bias again. I want to make that clear. I think that Muslims see themselves as very much in brotherly love, and there's a lot of embracing and holding and kissing one another when they see each other again. But in the university I work for anyway, it doesn't seem to work together as a university. There's a great deal of power grabbing, and maybe this is the nature of institutions as a whole, but between the different groups, and they don't seem to have a sense of one department working together with the other department. We're always fighting. Yes.
Speak about retribution or holding a grudge. The opposite does seem to be true, which is that the Arabs are extremely generous. I mean, everybody says,
yes.
If you give something to somebody, then they feel obligated or called to give back and more. And if you are to visit somebody's house and you comment on somebody's office,
yes,
or something, instead of that's pretty vague. They, it's part of the tradition, I guess, to give it to you.
Yes, that's right.
You.
Yeah.
You are expected to accept, so it's they're more than willing to be extra kind to you.
Yes, yes. There is that very good sense of generosity within America, and I wouldn't want to deny that. I mean, you know, we have done well by being there. They pay us a reasonable salary and reasonable benefits, but I think that's fine as long as it's all working together, but if there is a sense of conflict, then their attribution is really strong. There was a question in the back.
Just a comment about generosity with reference to many of the refugees coming in. Sometimes they're very good, for example, Pakistan and Afghanistan, Pakistan and men.
Well, there's a lot of political motivation there too. There is a strong sense. In fact, one of the pillars of Islam, one of the main five tenets, is sharing, almsgiving, sharing with the brothers. But it's very much to the brotherhood. It's very much sharing with other Muslims. I mean, they're going to help out Sudan, but they have not much time for Ethiopia. If I'm correct. Or maybe it's the other way around. I get mixed up as which one is the Muslim country and which one is seen as Christian. But, pardon me?
Ethiopia seems Christian.
Yes, I think that's right. Sudan and Somalia are in Muslim. Yes?
What is the standard for obeying holiness before God?
Obedience. Obedience. Okay, well, maybe I should go into it. Maybe it would be easier if I went into the five main tenets. In order to understand Islam, you have to, and I'll just do this quickly, it's the five pillars of Islam. And these are, first, the Shahada, the profession of faith. And this is what you see on the Saudi flag. I don't have a picture of it here. But it's if you look at the Saudi flag, it's green and green-white. And there's a sword and a palm tree and then Arabic writing, script. And what this script says is, there is no God but God, or there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. So if you profess that, you become a Muslim. If you profess it in a group of believers and you believe it in your heart, which only you know, you become a Muslim. You become a believer. And you can enter into Mecca, Medina, and you're accepted in the faith. And that's taken very seriously. So that's the first pillar. The second pillar is ritual prayer, to pray five times a day, dawn, midday, afternoon, evening, and night. This is kind of startling to us because the dawn prayer comes sometimes very early. In fact, it's just supposed to be just before dawn. And in the old days, which were not so long ago, a single man, a muezzin, would stand at the top of a minaret. The minaret is that tall, pencil-like structure that it's a kind of visual symbol of Islam, and would stand and shout out this prayer call, which starts with something, Ali al-Akbar, and it's a call to prayer, come and pray, come and pray. In the morning he says, prayer is better than sleep. So come to the mosque and pray. So this they are called to do five times a day. It's very ritualistic prayer. They all go together, and there's ritual not only in the words but in the movements. There's a This is what we see, the bending, bending at the waist, kneeling, kissing the ground. And this, they're called to do five times a day. And that takes a lot of obedience to disrupt your routine five times a day. And in fact, it becomes your routine. And many Muslims say that they feel totally out of whack when they're in Western countries, when they don't have this to kind of lead their day through. So that's the second. And the third pillar of Islam is almsgiving, the zakat, the sharing with the less fortunate. And it's not legalistically specified, but it's generally accepted around 2.5% or 1/40th of your income. This is usually a personal, not a state-designated thing, but it's expected of a true Muslim. The fourth thing is fasting. During the month of Ramadan, which we have just been through, in fact, Carol stayed through most of it. I came back early because my and brought our children back. But Carol stayed during the month of fasting.
Not because I wanted to fast.
Not because she wanted to fast.
I had to work.
But she had to work. They're supposed to fast during the whole day and not to eat, drink, smoke, or enjoy sex during the whole day. So, and this is from sunup to sundown. Now, after the sun goes down, they are free to do those things. But it becomes very difficult not so much the eating, I wouldn't think, but the absence of drink in the Middle East, where the sun is very intense. And didn't you say it was 120 degrees one day? So what happens then is their day gets switched around. Day becomes night, night becomes day. They celebrate at night, eat and make merry at night, and then sleep during most of the day. The work hours for those who do have to work are reduced, and the whole culture slows down. It's a bad time to visit the Middle East because of the slowdown, and many of the important people end up going to Europe. The university has struggled with this. They want to have this Islamic calendar, and of course, if you go by a lunar calendar, it's shorter than a solar calendar. So their year, as it were, moves through our year. So they have no seasons to their months. You know, when you're a child, the summer could be the month of Ramadan. When you're 13, it could be in winter, because it's slow. The year slowly moves through our calendar. So in the 3 years that we've been there, it's moved, almost a month and a half. So Ramadan started in the middle of June when we first came, and now it started in the middle of May, or earlier, or in the beginning of May. So they want to have their school year in accordance with the Islamic year, but they also want to be on a Western calendar so that they can get teachers, recruiting, and all of the setup of the rest of the world, the way the rest of the world operates. So it's kind of a paradox, and I think they're going to end up having to go with the Western calendar. But they want to. I don't know what will happen. We may have to stay through all of Ramadan next year and then give our exams afterwards or something.
That's why John has done that much sooner than I was. Working for Saudi University, he was done at Ramadan, May 8th.
Right.
I worked for an American school. I had to teach till June 4th, right through Ramadan. So he was done a full month before I was.
There are advantages. The fifth point of Islam, then, the fifth pillar, is the pilgrimage, the Hajj. And this is the trip to Mecca. Mecca is the holy city. And all Muslims, in their lifetime, if they can afford it, and this is important, if they can afford it, are required to visit Mecca and to fulfill the requirements. It's an incredible gathering. 1.5 million people visit in within the 13 days into Mecca. It becomes an international city where all these people from Indonesia to the Atlantic Ocean gather in there, and they go through the rituals of the Hajj, the circling around the Kaaba, and all the different rituals within Islam. In past times, it became, just as it was in Muhammad's time, a serious source of income. Okay, yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay. So those are the 5 points of Islam, the 5 main tenets. I've extended beyond the time. I'll be talking tomorrow about some other main points, social responsibility, and then about the expansion of Islam and the division of Islamic peoples between the Shiites and the Sunnis, and how that division started and how it's extended to our day and become a major force, especially in the war between Iraq and Iran. And also try to give somewhat of a quick response to a question response to Islam, how I see it. Yes. So you're free to go. I'll stay and answer questions if you want.
What the draw was for Christians and Jews to